candidates' cattle call, and political football. For the complete playlist of music and sound bites, go to the program's Facebook page. What's the Frequency, Paul? I'm Paul Fisher.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
I wait for you.
I wait for you. And I welcome you. You're listening to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Catherine, in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And you're listening to Earth at Midnight. And I guess that's what it is for all of us at this moment. Well, it's 3 minutes after, according to my clock. But it's an opportunity to lay back. Well, we don't want to lay all the way back. But, you know, relax a little and get into a conversation about what's happening with ourselves, with each other, and with the world itself. So what have you been experiencing with all this snow? Has it had an impact at all?
Not really. It's a little bit, a lot of hype, I think. It's
Well, they always hype it to be more than it is. I can remember when I was a child that there was real snow.
Me too.
I remember it wasn't just that I was shorter and I was a kid. The snow was really high.
I remember. 3 feet high.
Yeah, yeah, it was a lot of snow. And, you know, they build this as this big blizzard. Well, maybe upstate it was a blizzard. I don't know. But in New York City, it wasn't really a blizzard. It was like this soft, gentle snow. It just lasted 24 hours, I guess.
Exactly.
But it wasn't really very frightening as people thought it would be or were told it would be. And it was interesting. I went to the store, and all I needed to get was a couple of cans of cat food, and I needed a sweet potato. And it's like the lines were around the store because everyone's, you know, getting their survival stuff, you know.
God.
It was really funny. They have all their, you know, every possibility of what they could possibly need if they're snowed in, you know. And it was really funny because I didn't have any cat food, so I actually had to stand online.
Oh, my.
And so this line, people were getting all surly. What are you looking at me for? And
I was like, wow.
I barely noticed you. I wasn't really looking at you. And it was just really funny. And people were like so caught up in the moment of emergency, and banks were closing and stores were closing early. And so I was like, wow, maybe this is like a practice, an exercise for the real emergency.
That's what it felt like.
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting. It's sort of like with Hurricane Sandy.
Absolutely.
The year before there was a hurricane and they made a big deal about it, closed down all the subways, and it turned out to be nothing much.
Right.
But then the next year was the real hurricane.
Yeah.
So maybe it was just a practice for next year. We'll have a real blizzard.
Let's hope not.
It could be. It could be. But no, but it's just snow.
Exactly.
You know,
and it melts.
If it's 1 inch, if it's 3 inches, if it's 10 inches, it's just snow.
That's right.
I don't understand why people panic.
I don't either. I mean, unless you're... So, I mean, there are people in such vulnerable positions that if they have nowhere to go.
Well, I could see how homeless people would have a real problem.
Absolutely.
With the cold and the snow and the ice.
Absolutely. And if there's a low visibility with drivers and people can get run over, I get all of that.
Yeah. So I guess there are issues, but no reason to press the panic button,
right.
I think.
I agree.
And I think that it made me contemplate on how panicky people really are in general in their lives, in our lives. And I'm wondering how it started, how it got to be so people with such short fuses, you know, so concerned about things and worried about things. And I think I'm beginning to think it's the subway announcements. You ever get on the subway and they say, if you see something, say something in case of an emergency, if anyone leaves their bags. You know, people walk around in a perpetual state of fear.
Yeah, I've definitely seen how that dynamic plays out in other settings.
Yeah.
I've experienced, I guess what you'd say would be crowd chaos.
Yeah.
You know, where hundreds of people sort of react based on a complete rumor that was baseless.
Wow.
And so I've been right in the middle of it, where I've seen buildings empty out and people, you know, scramble for cabs based on a complete lie.
Like somebody made a call and make some kind of threat or something?
Yes. Or, you know, a band of people are coming, you know, to, they're protesting, you know, and they're walking from Herald Square and they're coming. And I've seen grown people and hundreds of them panic over that when it was a complete fallacy.
But even if it were true, what is there to fear?
That's true. It was, I don't remember exactly what the context was, mm-hmm. but I do remember being in the middle of it. And I think it was at a time where something had happened in New York City. And so there was all this anxiety. And somehow whoever spread that rumor must have wanted to see how the dynamic would play out. And people really panicked.
Well, that's not good.
No.
Especially to be in the middle of it. That could be very dangerous.
Absolutely.
And to be in the middle of a panicked crowd. This is why I tend to be just a little bit claustrophobic about crowds.
Hmm.
So I went to the first Million Youth March in, I think it was in, I forget the street, but it was in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I witnessed the way that they lock down a neighborhood and sort of pen people in. And it was a really scary experience because for the duration of the event, it wasn't so much a march as it was a rally because there was a stage. Everything was great the whole time. But then when the appointed time came for it to end, then the police went kind of wacky and helicopters started coming in.
Wow.
And I remember because I had like a press pass, I was at the very front of the stage. And behind the stage was all these riot police had lined up. And so at the point that the rally was supposed to be over, and of course it wasn't over on time, they stormed the stage and started throwing things around and pushing people around. And then, you know, the helicopters came down really low and people started to panic. And everybody was in these pens, so they couldn't get out.
I heard about that.
And there were lots of children there. You know, because it was considered to be a family event. And this was like at the beginning of the militarization of the police, I think. And ever since that event, I was like, I do not want to be in a crowd ever again.
I had the same experience quite a few years ago during a New Year's Eve crowd in Times Square.
Oh, I did that once.
I did it twice, and I would never again do that in this life for those that very reason. Not so much the helicopters, but being penned in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you don't know who's in the crowd, so anything can happen, and you can't leave.
Yeah, so, it's very... I don't understand it, really, because I've lived in New York City a long time, practically, you know, aside from short stints and living in other places my whole life. There's always been big crowds in New York City, and there's never been a problem before this whole... I think it's really started with Giuliani, the era of Giuliani might have been where it started. But they do this now to the West Indian Day Parade as well. It's like I can remember the first time I went to Eastern Parkway for the West Indian Day Parade, it was completely open. You could go in the street and dance with the people, follow along the floats. It was a real carnival festival atmosphere. And then all of a sudden they started penning off the street so that people couldn't cross the street, couldn't move around. And so everyone got trapped into these spaces. And it defies logic. It's not to keep the people safe. So I don't understand its purpose, really, if it has a purpose.
I'm sure there's a purpose. I just don't know what it is.
Maybe it's probably a purpose not for safety so much as to keep people in fear. There's so many things going on that are just seem to be designed to make people fearful of each other, fearful of being out, fearful of, you know, there's something untoward is going to happen.
Yeah,
it's a strange thing.
I think the last time is it, like when I was at one of these New Year's Eve events in Times Square, I noticed how the police were dressed in this sort of heavy, you know, military gear with the face masks. And I'm thinking, you know, what kind of threat would us, you know, what we be to them, that they'd have to wear, you know, face shields? And that completely turned me off. And
yeah,
it was just the sense that, you know, these, you know, us, we revelers would be a threat to them, that they'd have to be prepared for us.
Yeah, well, I think it's very strange. I don't think that that's the party line. I think the line is that, well, we have to be here because somebody might interject into the crowd of revelers, like somebody, some terrorist might come along, and we have to be ready for that eventuality. I don't know what else.
But then why would you pen people in so that if that person's among the crowd, you're the first ones that would be affected? So
yeah,
what?
It doesn't make it defies all human logic.
Yeah.
But it does bring up an interesting thought, because I actually have been thinking about this a lot, about how much it is fear. People's fear plays into the power, the way power is used in this country, and the way laws have been made, and the way our rights have been taken. It's all in the name of fear, really. Well, we can't have true civil liberties because we're fearful of some eventuality of somebody getting in the country or somebody creating a problem. And so there seems to be this need to create fear amongst the people.
Is this how you control people?
Exactly.
It's the only way that you can get people to do things they would normally never ever do.
I know. It's so amazing, and you're absolutely right about that. The reason I was thinking about it also is because of the conversation we had last week on the show,
mm-hmm,
when we were talking about how people were concerned about immigrants. Mm-hmm. A woman called, and I think she was in many ways being a devil's advocate, saying, well, this is what the people in my neighborhood are saying. Or maybe she felt that way, I'm not sure, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. But what happens is that people are making choices based on fear and based on a feeling of that there's not enough to go around. There's not enough money to go around. There's not enough education to go around. There's not enough food, not enough land, whatever it is. People feel like they have to have everything safe, ensconced for themselves, and have to be concerned if anybody else is around them that might need what they have.
Yeah, it sort of translates into everything's a zero-sum game. It's either you or me.
Yeah, and that's really not the way it is. I don't think that that's a reflection of reality, truthfully. I think the creation or the manufacture of this fear is what allows the situation to perpetuate, if that makes any sense. And because this is what the so-called representatives use create more and more restrictive laws. And so if you can convince a community that they have to be fearful of somebody that looks a little different than them, then that means that, okay, yeah, let's make restrictive freedoms because we don't want those people to have the rights that we have. Let's make restrictive laws in terms of finances. Let's make, you know, so everything seems to be geared towards creating a standard of separation, economic separation.
I think it's separation. It's scarcity, and but the scarcity isn't something that's necessarily a given. I think that the scarcity is because that funding is being used for other things.
They like
hope that
war.
You exactly. Yeah. They hope that you don't look at or you don't spend too much time thinking about. So that rather than fighting each other, you would look at the bigger picture and realize that you know there's more to this than just us. Us against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the resulting restrictive legislation or policies are designed to sort of further that sort of sense of separateness, you know, to pit people against each other.
Yeah.
Just as long as you don't look at the bigger picture. So you're always distracted.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. That's very true. I think that's why it's really something that we all have to consider in terms of following or finding a path of fearlessness for ourselves and how we engage in the world and with each other, that we have to challenge ourselves when we find that we are fearful of someone else.
I agree.
Or of some situation.
Totally agree.
Or of some particular challenge that we're facing. That it's the fear that creates the dynamic of difficulty and the dynamic of, that kind of escalates into something more. Because if people weren't so fearful, we wouldn't have, so many conflicts, of shootings, and if people weren't so fearful, even the police themselves are extremely fearful people. You know, they seem to be afraid of the people that they're here to serve.
Yes,
in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, and I think. But also, well, I guess I can't speak for them. But just the sort of wantonness of turning someone into a threat when all they're doing is just existing.
Yeah.
You know, you hear how, I guess it was this policeman in Ferguson,
mm-hmm.
how he described the guy, as this big threatening person. All the guy was doing is just... It's just existing. Same thing with the gentleman in Staten Island.
Yeah.
And so it turns into, well, if I perceive you, mm-hmm. In this way, therefore you are this way, therefore I have the gun and you don't. And therefore I'm justified in doing whatever I want to you. And we can discuss the real reasons later.
Right.
So it's very interesting how the sense of fear plays out. I think that it's a very broad area. There may be fearfulness for different reasons.
I think that that's true, and I'm not entirely sure that fear was the thing at play in these incidences.
Yeah.
But in general, there seems to be a manufactured sensibility of fear or threat. And I think that, black men face this more than anyone that I know of, especially in this country,
mm-hmm.
where there's this manufactured sense of that there's something to fear. There's something fearful about being a black man in this country, and it's it's kind of backwards and upside down and insane, but there's this manufactured idea that there's some kind of a threat, and when really the people who are more marginalized are less of a threat. And in our culture, I think people of color in general are somewhat marginalized, and black people for some reason are marginalized to the extreme of everyone else in this country. And it's just a curious thing that this mentality of threat is perpetrated and perpetuated in the media. And I really think that it's something that can only truly be undone through conscious choice, of individual conscious choice, of not being willing to be taken down that road of believing that to see someone as a threat. And very often it's not always, but often it's someone who's large in stature who gets attacked in this way. And not always, sometimes it's a child. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of interesting that this weird manufactured threat is what is there for the police. You know, that's what they're feeling, somehow threatened by a person, like you said, who's just existing, just doing their thing. But it doesn't begin and end with the police, but there seem to be the most dangerous perpetrators of that kind of fear.
Sure, I'm always thinking of, I mean, it's around the time when I was a little kid, but, you know, back in the day, when you had the civil rights activists, you know, these mm-hmm. young, brash, you know, well-educated kids who were daring and, you know, would be bold in terms of demanding mm-hmm. their rights and putting themselves on the line. And what happened in terms of the perception of them and how things have shifted over the last 40, 50 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, from these kids that maybe the, I don't know, I hate to use the word establishment, but that the, maybe the powers that be perceived as threatening, you know, to the underpinnings mm-hmm. of the view of the world, to perhaps impart a kind of effort to limit either their exposure or shape the way that they're perceived in the culture.
Mm.
From the young, you know, brash intellectuals to limiting what's considered acceptable expression of, you know, their musicality, their sense of who they are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that certain, for instance, recording companies will only accept a certain image.
True.
And that's what gets played.
Yeah.
And given the fact that those young kids that we have to watch documentaries to learn about them, they're not featured in the culture. So you have these young teenagers, adolescents growing up with only what they see before them. And that image is completely manufactured. So if you're supposed to be fearful of someone who totes a gun, but yet still has a car and has all the women in the world, you know, mm-hmm. that's supposed to be a reflection of them. So I would imagine it's kind of confusing.
Yeah.
But the fear factor mixed in with, you know, you're fearful, but, oh, don't you want to be like me, is something that I think, I don't know how it evolved, but I think I've been on the planet, I mean, I laugh, long enough to see how...
To see this transition.
Definitely.
Well, it is true. There has been a serious change in in the consciousness of young people.
Yeah.
Where it has been misdirected.
Absolutely.
Greatly misdirected. And I think that comes in combination with the education system that has been severely curtailed. So when I was going through the public school system, I don't know if it was a great system, but it was a very, there was so much potential there. There was so much opportunity there in the public school system. And there was a lot of creativity there. And, you know, there were arts, there was music, there was an opportunity to really get involved in the world at a very young age. And I don't think that that's true anymore. I think that kids go to school and teachers are forced into preparing these kids for these testings. And there are all these rounds of tests that they have to focus on. So I think the teachers really struggle to bring expansiveness and creativity into their school systems, those teachers who are dedicated enough to keep trying. But I think that there does seem to be a concerted effort to keep people's minds controlled, and it starts with the young, the very young.
Absolutely. And it ends up, I think, as I think about the shift over time, it takes subtle forms. I think it ends up to some extent being generational.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a certain point in time where things happened within certain communities of color, where you had things where, you know, drugs came into the communities,
mm-hmm.
you know, where people were coming back from the war,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of eroded the family structure. And then you have the generations coming from that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that is true. That is true. And it seems that a couple of generations were lost entirely.
Yes.
And you saw a situation where they were like children raising children, raising children, and there was no real comprehension on a bigger scale of what was happening.
Yes, and I don't know what the rationale was for the change in the way public school education was conducted, but my guess is that it's very rare or not very common for young kids these days to really learn about their social history,
mm-hmm.
so that they could see their place in history or the place of their parents or their grandparents,
yeah.
in history. And I'm guessing that that's part of the problem.
I'm guessing you're right. That makes a lot of sense to me. Anyway, for those of you who are tuned in, you're listening to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM. I'm Catherine Davis with Paulette Spencer. And we are having a conversation, and we're open to your thoughts. And you can join us at 212-209-2900, and it's a free-form conversation, so if we've inspired any thoughts that you would like to contribute to this dialogue, please do give us a call at 212-209-2900. I see a call coming through, so we'll say hello. How are you?
I'm from the Bronx here.
Yes, how are you?
I like to, you're phenomenal. I like to say that I was thinking of the program Democracy Now! By Amy Goodman. And now maybe she should have a new program. Plutocracy and Oligarchy Now!
Well, thank you. That's very lovely. And let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was yeah, I was listening to the conversation, and I thought back. There are certain things that happen, like you said, there's some things that happen generational. But I remember one of my favorite movies of all time is called E. And in that movie, it really captured a lot of what happened in the 70s. And
we talk what about movie was that?
Claudine, James Earl
Jones.
Oh,
yeah,
Carol.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And one of the things that's really put in the movie is that the kids are protesting jobs, not welfare. And see, when they did, one of the first things they did in that 70s was to remove, when people came back from the war, was to remove the man from the house, which was you didn't hire him. The woman had to work. And then she didn't make enough money, so she had to get welfare. In order to get welfare, you couldn't have a man live in your house.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, even if he, so the man had to actually disappear so his children could get fed. And they were, you know, they would report you if you had, you know, if you had a man coming around, et cetera, et cetera. But these things, you know, these are some of the things that we haven't passed down as far as knowledge, even in the war. My cousin was in the war, and there were a couple of guys that were killed from our area, and their parents would swear that they were killed by their own troops. And it's kind of something that wasn't really talked about. Okay. The black soldiers were, you know, fearful of being shot by their own people.
Wow.
And so, you have things that happen in these generations, but since we don't really talk about some of the things, like even when you talk about after Reconstruction, after the emancipation, you know, slavery that took place as far as convict lease programs, where people would just disappear and then come back, you know, years later, and where were you? And they wouldn't really talk about what happened to them, but they were picked up, given some false charges, and then leased out, and then for some, you know, at some miracle, they would make it back. But these are the conversations that we need to have between young and old. And when we experience a thing like babies, having babies, that's the conversation that's missed, because you don't have that, you know, that person in the house or the or that kind of contact, especially when the men are missing out of the house, you know, as things would happen with welfare and so on and so forth. But the education system right now is about money. It's about privatization. The testing thing is nothing more than, you know, dumbing down the students, but also, you know, who's going to administer the test? Who's going to, you know, we have to pay for those tests. We have to pay for the new textbooks.
Right.
We have to pay for, and it's a privatization of public schools. You know, it's guaranteed money. That's really, it's kind of a corporate welfare thing, because it's guaranteed tax dollars going to a corporation, you know, that's going to produce these things. My kid is learning new math, and this new math takes 3 or 4 times longer than old math. So my question is, you know, well, why are you dumbing down the kids and making them slower? But I think it's also, like you said, it's a thing where they're not letting them have that free thought, not producing more entrepreneurs. It's not producing more creative things that are coming out, more ideas. So you're stuck into the same idea in the same mode. And, you know, you look at music, and country music sounds like pop music because there's no creativity in it.
Yeah.
You know, and pop music sounds like R&B and so on and so forth, and it crosses over, and it's really just a big mix of not too good stuff now. Most stuff is not really that good, but that's, again, dumbing up, because when you look at the movements, and you talk about civil rights movement, and they talk about the music being important because it was a motivating factor, it was an educating factor. When you look in the 70s, it was a protest thing. It was black power. It was, you know, freed your mind kind of thing. And, you know, you look at what we have now, and there's no kind of social commentary. There's no kind of, I don't think it's not much that's out there that's uplifting, you know, or not much that really talks about real life situations. Like I said, there's a manufactured persona out there, you know, and this is what they're playing to. This is what the kids get to watch. And, you know, when I was in school, and one of the things about the history and being the children being taught their history and their place in history. When I was in school, when we came through, basically, and I graduated in the 80s. But all that time, we were just taught that, you know, we were black people were slaves. Yeah, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. And we did nothing. Then all of a sudden, there was Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Very little on Malcolm X, by the way. And then we got our voting rights, and that was basically what we contributed to America. And then when I went to college, I've never seen so many angry young black people because we took African-American history and began to learn. And we're looking around like, they could have told us this.
Yeah.
Because all it was, all you had to say was black people were there, too. You know, when it came down to, I discovered this past summer that I have a relative that was a runaway slave. We always knew we had a one ad for a runaway slave. It's one of our relatives here in New Jersey. And I didn't know. I grew up in one town, basically two towns away from where he was slaves. We didn't know they had slaves in Central Jersey.
Wow.
But my great-great-great-grandfather, he is, they took his, he was a slave, and he bought 11 acres of property with his free wife while he was still a slave. So they have, I don't say memorialized, they have sectioned off the park and made it a kind of a city park, you know, for his, that was his property as a historic thing.
Wow.
But we never knew growing up, and I grew up in this area, I mean, all of my life. I have a lot of relatives, but we never knew that there was slavery here. You know,
well,
it was different, and this is something that, you know, we could have been taught.
Yeah.
As part of our historic, you know, that fact could be celebrated, the bicentennial, I think, Frank. This is an area, I'm in New Jersey, so, you know, it's an area where George Washington was around, a lot of fighting, including, you know,
well,
a lot of battles that went on.
Also, one of the things we were never taught is that, you know, black people were here well before the Europeans, and we're living free just like the other indigenous people here. And, you know, we weren't taught that, you know, there's a lot of history that we're still have not been taught. So we need to really take a look at that and begin to make it accessible. We have another caller who's been hanging on, so I'm going to try to get to that call. I really appreciate your contribution. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Call again. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. Borrowing from a thought of Eckhart Tolle having to do with a person making decisions and where that leaves their personality, if one is constantly making decisions predicated upon what's happened in the past, they have no present, no time in the now, is problem number one. Problem number two is, if you accept the idea that where your attention goes is where your energy flows, and number three, if one needs a new paradigm, then one needs a new way of doing these things. If you play by their rules, or you try and play within the game, you can't change the game without becoming immersed in the game. So you need a completely different way of approaching the paradigm. And that begs a fourth issue of the evolutionary imperative. So in order to be in the now and stop chasing what's happened in the past and becoming, having your focus being altered by all the negativities and scarcities that are being perpetrated upon you, you need to withdraw from it and raise your frequency and your energy, which is what they want. You know, to say that it's energy, it's not heat energy, it's not electric energy, it's not solar energy, it's your psychic energy that they want to control. So in order for you to have some independence, you have to evolve. You have to raise your frequency. You have to stop playing their game, and you need to be going forward on a different, in a different way, in a different path that we have not utilized yet. And that involves, as you might put it, the key, the energy, the QI, not the KEY.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I agree. And
yeah,
it's a sense of maybe has to do with what I was mentioning as the distraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to get rid of the distraction so you can focus on that energy.
But they're going to constantly, they're going to, as with 9/11, as with wars, as with all the pharmaceutical stuff, as with all the different layers of of the blocks of the pyramid on the back of the $1 bill. There's a million different ways they've been studying us for thousands of years on how to manipulate us. The only way you're going to be able to get off the wheel is to stop participating in it. You know, if one were to raise the issue of unconditional love within the universe in terms of creation and the creator, one would be able to say, hey, Rockefeller, who's charging you and what are they charging you for the use of the sun and the air out there? And how can you charge for that? Well, if you don't make it available to yourself and don't start utilizing it and make some mistakes along the way, you get bogged down in their game.
Yeah, I really do agree with you. I think it's just a question of coming to an understanding on, as you said, how to eliminate the distractions and how to step away from that game, because there's a sacrifice to be made and a price to pay on a personal level if you're not playing that game, you know, because the system doesn't support that. So if for people who don't want to play that game, what do they do? What do they actually really do for energy? Because any of the inventions that have been presented have been either bought out, suppressed, or in some fashion. So it becomes a question of what steps can we take to make this transition of pulling out of that game. I think we could stop spending money would be a good first step.
Well, wait a minute. Spending money raises a slightly different issue called currency. In other words, as I was saying with Rockefeller, who's charging him for the use of something that was there long before he was there and long after he will be there? And the issue is that you might say, well, you're alive. And if the game is not the currency of money, and that's a fallacy, then what is the currency of the currency of life is participation in it. So one has to participate in a different way. If you don't like the relationship that you're in as a man and a woman, it is the obligations upon you to do something to change it, withdraw from it, and or pursue a different one.
I understand exactly. I understand in principle what you're saying. However, I think it's easier to withdraw from a relationship than it is to withdraw from the economic educational system. I'm not saying that it's impossible. I agree that it's necessary. I just think it's something that has to be worked upon, thought about, and so that we know exactly where does one go. How does one live through that withdrawal from the system?
First, you have to do it and make some mistakes along the way before you can come to the point of, well, how can we refine it? And what
okay.
you want to do is perfect it before you've even done it.
No. I have another call I'd like to
Surely.
Take. Okay,
have
but I really appreciate your thoughts. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I'm upset about these remarks you made about the Ferguson, the Missouri shooting.
Okay.
Now, if you want to have a decent, honest argument, you ought to be objective. You proceeded on the prejudice that he was just minding his own business. The facts of the case that were investigated for a number of months were that when the police officer arrived at the scene and attempted to open the door, he slammed it shut, reached inside the window, tried to punch the officer in the face, and then reached for a gun. Now, when you do these things, you don't expect pleasant things.
That doesn't sound
happen.
Like anything I've ever heard about this case.
Well, what did you hear?
That he was minding his own business.
He was minding, and did you not also understand or discover that he was robbing a store previous to this incident?
No.
Oh, you did? Oh,
I appreciate the perspective you're giving. That's not what I know.
Excuse me. Hello?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My counsel is, before you make an argument, you should gather your facts. Apparently, you're unknowledgeable about what actually happened. Go back, read the newspapers, do some research.
Thank you. We'll do that, huh?
Well, my point was not so much someone just standing around. I think my sense of the Ferguson, they found out that the guy robbed the store after the fact. It wasn't a case of, well...
They went after him because he robbed the store?
My understanding is that they found that out. The policeman didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe other people know things that maybe I'm glossing over, but that was the impression that I have. And I didn't mean... I don't mean so much that someone's just standing there, but there's always been a pattern of assuming things about people and then trying to
justify
your assumption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talked about Giuliani. You know, he was famous for having his force go after people, whether they were armed, unarmed, and then try to dig into their past to justify, you know, what they couldn't have possibly known to do whatever they did to this person. That's been a pattern over and over and over again.
Okay.
And so that's my point. It's, you know, whether someone did something before, I'm not sort of talking about that, but I don't really want to get excited about this.
Mm-hmm.
But Giuliani, for instance, was known for, you know, walking up to someone, or not him walking up to, but having a police force that would pick people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what all of the stop and frisk is about. It's not about having any sense of a crime having been committed, or having any sense of the person's being a threat. It's really just profiling a certain group of people and creating a incident, and as you said, then to go and justify that incident, which I suppose can happen on certain incidences. But I've witnessed some of this, the kind of brutality that is visited upon people, where, you know, I've seen someone who maybe they, you know, tried to jump over the turnstile, so they stole the fare, whatever, and maybe 8 cops will jump on that guy, you know, and they'll push him to the ground, or women, and twist them and hit them. And it's, to me, it seems like a great excessive force, whatever the case may be. And from the perspective of a person being targeted, when they're just existing and living their life, I understood the point that was being made. But the caller has a point. I don't actually watch the news, so it's true. I probably am uneducated about the all the facts. So I think he has a point well taken. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that if you're talking about Ferguson getting upset about that, what about the fact that 90-something percent of young black men are killed, murdered by other black men? Why is it anytime a white cop does something wrong, people get upset, but when thousands of young black men are getting shot down and killed in the streets day in and day out by other black men, we don't really hear as much of an outcry?
Well, that may be true. That's a very good point. And I think there's two ways you can look at this, that there's not a lot of press when black people are killed in that way. But I think it's a serious problem, and I agree with you, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not saying that that cancels out the outrage of the brutality of the police, but it is something to look at. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I thank you for taking my call, and I would just like to say this one thing.
Could you speak up a little?
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, that's a little better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, previous callers, speaking of Ferguson and speaking of facts, I think we should not forget that this country went into a war and killed thousands of people over facts presented by Colin Powell at the, what is it? He presented it to the world. These were facts. Facts on what? Mass destruction. Okay? Which, when one really analyzed and sought the truth, it's discovered they're lies.
Yeah,
so
that is true.
We, and as far as black on black crime, and I will say this, African descent, people of African descent killing people of African descent, or Africans killing Africans. We've never looked at the number of wars fought by Europeans, killing Europeans, slaughtering Europeans by the thousands.
Yeah, hundreds of
we
thousands.
We have to look
yeah.
at also the destruction of almost the entire grouping of the indigenous people of this land, okay? Caused by whom? So it is not, we can't justify, oh, well, what about blacks killing blacks? What about Europeans killing Europeans? You see, it gets to be into a thing where it's tit for tat. If we're going to seek the truth and know the truth, I mean, as far as the young man in Ferguson, keep in mind, you know, the caller stated, well, he committed a crime. He committed a crime that was what? You are judging. You have passed verdict on someone who was never, ever charged or tried for a crime.
This is true.
So, you know, facts. If we're going to seek facts, then keep in mind it was the newspapers that spread the quote truth unquote. Oh, weapons of mass destruction. How many lives, hundreds of thousands of lives, have been lost over what? People preaching what? Lies that they state are facts. So let's get off of this, oh, Africans killing Africans. All right? Mm-hmm. This country, in the mass destruction of its people from germ warfare, committed on its people from the institution of penal institution where they experiment on people. Think of the Tuskegee experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Think of even when Guatemala sued or asked for reparations for the continuation of that experiment of syphilis on their people. Okay, in 55. So let's get real. If we're going to speak facts, let's speak the truth. Let's not try to interpret.
Right.
Okay, what we feel we can get over with.
Well, I appreciate your perspective, but it also brings me back to mind for me that, you know, the even the fact that we're having this kind of conversation, I'm not calling you out, you know, through these phone calls, of getting into this tit for tat, as you were saying, it's like we're being pulled into through our own consciousness into this dynamic of conflict and war, and again being distracted from finding any real solutions by trying to have these dialogues. So I really appreciate your balancing perspective. Thank you.
And I thank you for being so calm and being able to basically take the attacks that are thrust upon you. You have a wonderful show. Thank you.
Bye for now. Bye. Interesting. Yeah, because I think part of the focus coming into the show was to think about how fear plays out. And here is an example of how it plays out, just in the dialogue of feeling like there needs to be a defense against a person's perspective. So... and defense against each other. And it's interesting how easy it is to fall into that dynamic.
And I think that, yes, and there's a lot of, I think, very valid points to how manipulation is used, not just at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone's saying, well, you don't value your life, so why should we? So the issue isn't about value of life. It's more like, well, if you can do it, we can do it too. And that's
right.
The end of the argument. To the higher level, international level, which is, well, we're going to get what we want, even if we have to manipulate you into manufacturing consent for us to do what we want to do.
Right. And that's really what it comes down to. We have a couple more folks trying to call in. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I called the... calling back, and people speak about Ferguson and cops shooting white cops, black on black crime. I mean, white cops shooting black kids and black on black crime. The difference is, in so we can end the tit for tat, the difference is that cops are paid to protect and serve. And to shoot the citizen, the person that's paying your salary, is crazy. Now, you know, black on black crime, normally, those are criminals. Criminals shooting other criminals. Not necessarily going out and assassinating someone who just went to the store to get a Snapple and a bag of chips. You know, so mm-hmm. There's a big difference in what cops shooting kids and black on black crime. And as statistics shows, black people don't kill black people any more than white people kill white people, or et cetera, et cetera. It's just the numbers kind of run the same. The disproportionate number is how many blacks end up in jail, or that are in jail, as to the, in ratio to the population. To raise, and I understand you want to, it's difficult to raise out of the situation, to bring your psychic up, to bring your chi up, to get out of the situation, because it's an attack. It's not something that's a dynamic. And I believe that the fear that police officers have, and as someone said, I read this somewhere, someone asked their white friend if, are you afraid of black people? And the white friend said, yeah. And he said, well, why are you afraid? He said, well, we're waiting for the day that you guys burn down the country. For everything that you've been, everything that's been done to you, we're just waiting for the day for you to explode. So there's a fear out of the guilt. Out of both white privilege, there's a fear out of the guilt of police officers, because, until cell phones and the recording on cell phones became prevalent, both on social media and on TV, until that became prevalent, no one believed that these things are really happening.
Well, that's a good point, yeah.
So now that these things have people, what cops have done and not all cops. I have friends that are police officers. But there's some police officers that are out there. And the problem, one of the main problems is, and what we should allow, is for police officers to raid other police officers and to whether to vote them on or off the force.
Mm.
Because if you have a problem, you know who the problem police officer is. But you can't say anything because your job could be at stake.
Well,
look at any whistleblowers from,
Yeah, actually, my eldest brother many years ago was in the police force, and that's what happened to him. He reported activities by the police that were untoward, and they set him up. They tried to, the people who were in the force at that time, they sent him into a situation without backup, and he could have lost his life. So I think there is a fear factor.
Well, another option would be to end some of this, is hire more black cops.
Yeah.
Because they don't shoot people accidentally. And if you look, and I remember reading back in some of the things were going on in the Village Voice back in, Village Voice was reporting some things in New York City. And in friendly fire incidences, 100% of the time, it was a white cop shooting a black cop.
Hmm.
So there is a fear that if you speak up, you could catch one in the back of the head and no one goes to jail. It was an accident. The person can retire because of psychological damages or whatever it was, and with his full salary. So what is it for, a cop to report another cop?
But I think it's absolutely necessary for people in these agencies to speak out and to intercede, because to me one of the most frightening scenes of this police brutality is all of the other cops standing around gaping as if, they couldn't do anything about it. And I think that there's a level of responsibility and accountability there that needs to be upheld.
Yeah, and I think that because even, the insane part of these recent shootings, that these are caught on camera, and some of these behaviors are caught on the own police camera.
Yeah.
So they have no fear of prosecution. They have no conscience as far as what they're doing. The only way I believe that, to root out these people is to allow, again, and it's something that cities and states should explore, is to allow anonymous tips or anonymous opinions so that you can, a rating system by your fellow officers. And just like they want to rate teachers and get rid of them because they're bad, they should do the same thing with police officers.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Thank you for your contribution again.
And thank you for your show.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right.
Yeah, it's interesting to be immersed in all this and to need and recognize the need to rise above it.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's sort of a flash in our lives when these things happen. And it grabs all of our consciousness, but it's not every day for most people to have this kind of an experience. Even most black people, I don't think it's an everyday thing to encounter this kind of experience. But when it does happen, it just grabs you. It grabs everyone.
I think perhaps it depends on the neighborhood.
Well, that's true too.
And it depends on your age group, and it depends on I don't know whether or not it's your physical dress or what have you, but I live in an area of New York City where you see a lot of young kids, young men of color who always seem traumatized. And I can't even imagine what it's like to have to be an adolescent in an environment that tries to get you to assume that you're guilty of something just for existing. The mere fact that you have a stop and frisk, what does that do to someone to grow up thinking that because they look a certain way, they a certain gender, they must be guilty of something? And that's the entire message. We're here to catch you on what you're naturally guilty of. I mean, I don't see what could be more damaging to someone's psyche. And we're talking about a time of their psychological, emotional, intellectual development that's rapidly changing. And they're taking in what society's sort of giving them as a message.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that rather despairing. So I think it depends on who you are and where you are.
Absolutely. Well, that is true, because even if you're not, if you hadn't encountered that impact of the stop and frisk, the fear is generated and you're living in that atmosphere of fear.
Sure.
And intimidation. And then, and the reality is that many of these young people do end up in our prison system for not much. And then it builds, because I remember that was the whole point of the, when Giuliani started arresting people for minor crimes. Because if you arrest someone 10 times for a subway fare, then that multiplies into a big sentence. And so it gives an opportunity to fill those privatized prisons upstate. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also the sense of who has the moral authority.
Mm.
I think that's something that plays out really strongly. So I think that part of the sort of intimidation of the fear factor is that one side, the side that has the legally owns the guns and can do whatever they want with you, have also the moral authority.
Right.
And
so-called.
Yes.
So that does leave us, I think, with a great challenge on how to protect these children. That I think maybe that needs to be a priority of elders in this community.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that it's essential to nurture young people. I think it's extremely important and to show them, you know, that there is a sense of dignity, humanity, responsibility, accountability, warmth, love, friendship, support that exists in the world. That it's not just about someone having to physically fend for themselves every time they set foot out of their homes.
And as you said, in a lot of these situations, or as one of the callers said, they're very often from homes that are not stable. The father might already have gone through that experience and be in prison, or may have been in the military and have had that experience. And, you know, the poverty, they may be experiencing levels of poverty. So maybe that's part of what we need to think about. I have to watch the clock.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. And there's also, as I mentioned earlier, the sense of people being shell-shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're, you know, you think of PTSD as people, you know, being out in the war field somewhere, but there's PTSD within the community, things that young people end up witnessing, you know, that leave an impression on them. People who witness shootings, stabbings, domestic violence, all sorts of things that they end up bottling up, and they show the signs of that kind of trauma that can stay with them for a lifetime.
Mm.
And they don't get the, you know, they may not get the luxury of sitting down with a therapist.
Well, given the difficulty of acquiring health care, true health care, that's probably very true. And I think there's a possibility that they wouldn't even think about seeking it out.
True.
Yeah, and then like you said, it's when you're fighting that sense or that judgment that you're already wrong, that you've already done something, then you begin to believe that and internalize it.
Exactly.
And then you're not thinking in terms of getting the kind of help. No one is thinking about the kind of nurturing that you're talking about, and that's exactly what's called for. A nurturing, a being able to awaken the creativity and the spirit within those young people. Because I saw, even in the era that I went to school, how school was very different from my brother's.
Mm. How?
In the sense that they started out these, well, maybe it's just the boy thing, I'm not sure, but they all went through a sort of a destructive process in schooling, where they ended up being, you know, really having real challenges in school, and having real challenges with you know, fighting, or with being able to pass their grades and studying. And so there, somehow there was a challenge that they experienced that I didn't experience. And I thought it was maybe that the system, or I don't know what it is, but it was a different experience for them than it was for me as a girl. And I think that that's still true. Somehow boys are not honored in some way in our school systems. I'm not sure why or what it is, but that was how I mean, that was something that I did notice. Hello, you're on the air?
Hi.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just calling to say that I think that we really have not understood that we're not... Oh, my God. Hold on. I'm sorry. I have to go. Bye-bye.
Okay. Oh, that would sound like it was going to be good. Call back. Hello, you're on the air.
Sorry, I have to go. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Oh, please turn off your radio.
It's going to be good. Call back.
Oh, okay.
Turn off your radio. You're on the air.
It is off. Kathy?
Okay, yes.
Good evening, my sister.
Good evening.
It's so nice hearing your voice.
Thank you.
I love you.
Oh.
And I would always do. This is Willie.
Oh, hi.
How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. So nice hearing you.
Now you're going to...
What?
You're going to get me with your comment.
No.
Okay.
I'm not going to be disrespectful, you know. Yeah, I love the air, and I was doing it like that. You know, never done that kind of thing, but I'm going to speak the truth as I know it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I have no interest in how you may take it or how you feel about it, but, you know, the truth is the truth. That's all I'm interested in. I'm not interested in anyone's opinion or their belief. Two things I'm interested in is the fact and the truth.
Okay, so let's hear it.
From my perspective, look. Mm-hmm. The African, all of these things are documented from an African perspective, and white, another white, you see. For example, you're talking about their thought on it starts from the children, the babies, starts from there. Dr. Kwanzaa Kandufo, he did up the research and all of that. There's always an assault on black men, black people in this country, you see. Now, when we speak about, they will always justify the evil by turning around and pointing at the victim, victimized. So that's what they do. Let's look at the fact. The United States is a criminal nation, period.
Well, that's true.
Wait, hold on. How did they get started? Murder, robbery, and kidnapping. Simple. You may not like it, but how much did they pay for this country? Didn't they murder the people that was living here? Did they not kidnap the Africans to build it? That's a fact. So you're looking at a criminal people as a just people. We are the victims of the criminality. We are hated in this country more than anybody else. You see, we're not talking about... for example, look at what this caller just said. Oh, it was reaching in the car. That's the story that's always been told if you're following these things.
Mm.
Ferguson is not just Ferguson. That's the entire United States, period. These are the incident that has been spotlighted. It's as simple as that. That's our problem here. You see?
Mm.
So when you look at it from that perspective, we are going to make all kinds of arguments. It's very simple. Look, as far as my concern is, the solution is young men and women joining the Nation of Islam. It's as simple as that. They don't have that kind of problem. Whatever the reason why they don't have it, I don't know. Well, I won't say because the police are respected. The police, everybody respect them. Even the drug dealers in our community, they respect them. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I don't, but I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't really make sense to me.
Let me finish my thought. Giuliani, we know he has a vengeance against black men, period. Why? Arnolfo, his wife, left him for a brother. So he has a personal vindiction against African men, period. So I don't even want to speak about what he has to say. Let's look at he said the police officers up in Harlem, in the mosque. We're still not supposed to go in there. But he's going to do what he has to do to prove himself. What was the end result of that? The police, what was it, you see what I'm saying? So that's one solution we could look at.
Well, I guess we could. So it is something that people can look at. I don't necessarily see that as the solution, though it may be that the coherence of the Muslim community is something that could be replicated in the greater communities of the city. And, you know, this sense of educating. So,
exactly.
You know, educating the children,
exactly.
Giving guidance to their children. But I don't necessarily think that a religious solution is the solution to the problem. But maybe the family solution is, because there was a time that black families were very strong and very coherent.
Absolutely.
They still are in a lot of places, but, you know, I think what I was referring to is that I think that rather than saying that young people need to go join something, I think elders need to begin to approach young people and offer them assistance and offer them guidance. I think there needs to be a hand extended to young people from people who have more experience and from people who have resources, financial resources. There's no reason why we have some very wealthy people of color in this country, black people, brown people, of all races. There's very, very wealthy people in this country who should and could make a difference in poor communities.
Okay, here's a problem with that argument. I agree with you on what you said, but the truth is they're not extending themselves. The nation is. They're welcome in there, you see? And we know that we do not have that problem between the police or anybody with these people.
Well, I understand your perspective. I don't happen to agree, but it's a fair offering in terms of a potential solution. It may be the solution for some people. It may be the perfect solution, but I don't think it's a universal solution.
Let me move on from that. Okay, what about black and black crime? I mean, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Nobody is supposed to kill anybody, period.
Of course
not. But the fact is, Italians kill Italians. Chinese kill Chinese. Japanese kill Japanese. That's just the social norm. But for the police to be killing African men, that's where the problem is. And that's that has been the history in this country. They're not... Right now, the United States and the Western world is at war with the Islamic world. There are many Muslims from the East here. They're not killing them. It's African men. They're not killing Chinese. They're not killing Japanese. They're not killing Koreans. It's only African people they're killing. They paid to serve and protect the people. So how are you going to compare... some talks in the neighborhood killing one another with people who are paid to protect the people.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Another caller did bring up that point. We have to reach the point quickly because we're running out of time.
Okay, not a problem. I'll get off, okay? I'll let somebody else on.
No, okay.
Hope to see you soon.
Okay, same here. Bye-bye.
Love you, honey.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye now. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we just have a few more minutes till the end of our show here today. Interesting dialogue, I must say. And I guess I would have to say that I'm portraying a bit of a bias, my own personal bias, in not thinking or not being able to perceive a religion as a solution or religious practice as the solution. But certainly I could be more open to it in the sense that I believe that spirituality is part of the solution. Coming to a sense of full selfhood and understanding, coming to true knowledge of who we are as beings. And I believe that children need to have a full comprehension of how deeply sacred they are as beings and how valuable they are as beings. And I think that that's part of the solution. I'm not sure that religion carries that. Religion, it may. I'm not convinced that it does.
I agree. I guess, I mean, mm-hmm. I went to 8 years of Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that after going through that, and some people, you know, for some people, Catholicism, you know, is the answer. And I respect that. But I think that my own sense of developing as a person came out of my meeting people from other belief systems,
mm-hmm.
and realizing that we had so much in common, whether you called it, you know, Christianity or you know, Hinduism or Buddhism, that there was this sort of sense of being kind to each other, respectful,
mm-hmm.
honest. And I saw it as a larger picture across mm-hmm. the world. And so I agree with you that for a sense of spirituality of that part of yourself,
mm-hmm.
That I think, as I said earlier, it's a sense of nurturing, loving, supporting, listening.
Yeah.
I think all of that's part of the answer. And you may find it in all different types of venues, but at the end of the day, they're all very similar.
Yeah. So I guess it would depend on the, I think it depends on the individual. I think for some people it would work very well.
Yeah.
Certainly wouldn't work for me. I'm not about to to conform in to that degree. I think probably from my perspective of being a woman, it requires a certain amount of conformity and behavior that I can't conceive of.
I think for me,
you know, dress, I couldn't conceive of it.
Yeah, and for me it was just a sense of being segregated.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't, as a 14, 15-year-old, I couldn't see why I had to be segregated from other religious groups. You know, if we're all the same,
yeah.
I thought that, well, then we're all the same. Then I can go wherever I want and talk to you and learn from whomever
you want. Exactly.
Yeah.
That is the truth. That is the truth. But interesting conversation. But I would really like to think about doing something. I don't know what, though. But I know you actually have an opportunity to interact sometimes with young people. And I rarely do, but I think I'm going to seek it out a little bit more because I think that that's what's needed. I think that there needs to be attention given and some, you know, some care interjected into the situation so that people can be in a situation where they can love who they are.
Absolutely.
They have to know that they're lovable and that they deserve respect. And we're out of time. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. And this has been Earth at Midnight. And we're an interim program following after the tradition of Earthwatch with Robert Knight. I'm Catherine Davis, and in studio with Paulette Spencer. Thank you for joining me today, Paulette.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go out with a little bit of Buffy St. Marie, And since we've had a lot of snow lately, let's see how easy that can be.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a recorded edition with wonderful stuff nevertheless. Our guest, rebroadcast from a year and a half ago, Kim Stanley Robinson. Stay tuned. once again, good morning. As mentioned, this is a recorded edition of Hour of the Wolf, recording it on the morning of broadcast, so we're pretty au courant, as it were. And while the roads may be plowed and clear, parking is still not easy. Can't say about up at CCNY, where the WBAI studio in the crypt is located. However, where I am, once I leave here, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to park again and just, you know, rove around the neighborhood like Charlie in the Streets of Boston, being the person who never returned or something like that. Well, I figured a recorded program would be safer this way. And for this week, I have chosen an interview, first broadcast about a year and a half ago, September of 2013, with one of my favorite writers, Kim Stanley Robinson, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I have something to promote, and that is the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading series, which the next edition of is this coming Tuesday, February 3rd. And it's located at Gallery Lala, or the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, depending on where you choose to put it. But one way or the other, it's at 138 Sullivan Street, a few steps down between Houston and Prince. And we have two wonderful, wonderful writers. Regular listeners to the show may well have heard both. Carlos Hernandez is somebody who I first met when Delia Sherman brought him on the program when she was working on Interfictions. And he is a writer with over 30 publication credits in a variety of genres, fiction recently published in crossed genres in Antimatter, and an SF one-act play published in Geek Theater. By day, Carlos is a CUNY Associate Professor of English with appointments at BMCC and the CUNY Graduate Center, and a game designer currently working as the lead writer on the Lewis and Clark CRPG Merryweather, now in beta. Not sure what a CRPG is. I know what an RPG is. Well, he lives in Queens, which he says is most notable for not being Brooklyn. Well, I lived my first 40 years in Queens, in the same neighborhood, as a matter of fact, as Carlos, so I'm not going to say anything bad. I love that neighborhood. Jennifer Marie Brissett, is a writer, artist, former bookstore owner, and a former web developer. She is a Jamaican British American who emigrated to the U.S. when she was about 4 and grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In her late 20s, she moved to Brooklyn. Yeah, there we go, Brooklyn again. Where, for 3.5 years, she owned and ran the indie bookstore Indigo Cafe and Books, which was a very special place. She has a master's in creative writing from the Stone Coast MFA program and a bachelor's in interdisciplinary engineering. That's electrical engineering with a concentration in visual art from Boston University. Her writing has been included in The Best of Halfway Down the Stairs, 2005-2010, and a finalist for the 2013 Story South Million Writers Award. Her debut novel, Elysium, published by Aqueduct Press, has been shortlisted for the 2014 Philip K. Dick Award. And that's really thrilling. That's really great. Jen was on the program just about when the novel came out, and it has been getting fabulous reviews and a lot of notable notices. So one of the other thrilling things, which she didn't mention in her bio that I just read, was that there was an article, 33 most needed audiobooks, not put out in 2013, and Elysium, her novel, was number one on that list. So, yay. So this is a really good duo, both people that were at one time or another involved with, the same writers group as Rick Bowes and other people who've been on the program. And We hope you'll come. Admission is free. We do beg for donations at the door. But if you can't afford it, come anyway. It's next Tuesday, February 3rd. Doors will open about 6:30. If you come a little early, you can shop around on the upper floor of Gallery Lala and then descend into the cellar. The cabaret is what I call it. And enjoy two very fine readers. And here's one more note. A listener by the name of Barry sent me an email alerting me to the fact that Turner Classic Movies is going to be broadcasting a film called Twice Upon a Time, a 1983 seldom-seen animated film produced by George Lucas, including voices such as our own Marshall Efron and Hamilton Camp and Lorenzo Semple, a lot of really good people, using some kind of stop animation involving cutouts. Okay. I tell the entire story of how I met Stan Robinson in the interview. This was a Skype recorded interview, and that's something I really don't care to do. I really, really, really prefer one-on-one interviews, where face-to-face is what I mean by that. Because there's a rapport issue, but this was the third time I had interviewed Stan, and he is always an exception. And he had a new book out in late 2013, and that provided a good excuse for an interview. He has so many books, so many series that are well worthwhile. A couple of collections of short stories, The Planet of the Table, Escape from Kathmandu, Remaking History, came out in 1991. He has a book called Antarctica, which is a place where he has spent time in order to research some of his writing. Pacific Edge, The Gold Coast, The Wild Shore, The Years of Rice and Salt, 40 Signs of Rain, 50 Degrees Below. But my personal favorite is probably Red Mars, which is still to date, even though it came out in 1993, and between the time that he wrote it and the time it came into print, certain things were found out about permafrost and, you know, science moves on. But the politics of it are fabulous and wonderful, as well as the science. And this series of books, Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars, are an epic in the grandest sense of the word. If you needed to start in any one place, I would say Red Mars. And trust me, you will be hooked. So enough from me. Let's listen to this interview recorded a year and a half ago with Kim Stanley Robinson. This is Jim Freund. I'm speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson on the afternoon of the 24th, 3 hours difference, because you're in California and I'm here in New York. And this is, I think, you probably don't remember, this is actually our third interview. One time being a very long time ago. I can't even begin. I'm not even sure of the decade. I just know it was in New York. It was at a Nebula event, and Dave Hartwell introduced us at a party, and we went off for about 10 minutes.
I remember that. I think that was 1991.
That could be. Mm-hmm. And then after that, when you were guest of honor at Capclave, we ran into each other two nights, actually, with a whole bunch of the Capclave people, the night before the convention was going to begin. And there was a great Mets versus St. Louis Cardinals game that a whole bunch of us watched together. With a great...
If I was the guest at